Thanks, Sharon, for organizing this. Ray Almaris was very interested in getting out information and learning things. And in the process, he used a lot of tools. And if he didn't have the right kind of tool, he made it. As far as I know, he never patented any of his inventions. Maybe he did, and I don't know about it. He just wanted to get the data. He wasn't trying to make a name for himself. And one of the tools that he used was developed by Pikul and Almaris called the incremental sampler. It's a very nice tool. And as best as I counted, there was 8 journal articles and 1 book chapter that he published in this area. I've also published a few more, and I still use that same type of equipment. So that's going to be the first part. And then I'm going to have a little bit on one of his research topics that greatly influenced me, and this is the topic of plant water use, for which I counted 4 journal papers. Okay, there he is. I think that was in the little introduction thing, showing me how to take an incremental sample. And he took multiple samples and pulled them together. After taking the sample was pushed out from the bottom onto a tray that was marked into increments. Then these increments were sliced up, and they were pulled together at that increment, but at the different cans were for different depths within the soil. This is what the tool looks like that we use in Iowa now, because basically my technician is very good at gadgets, so I just described the tool to him and he made one and improved it a little bit. And let me see if I can get this. Okay, we have, I'm not making an arrow, oh well. we have this nice little handle. This extension part here is sort of like the top of a fertility sampler. This bottom part is different, however, because instead of having a cutout part, it's a cylinder. And then on the end is a soil fertility cutting tip, which is a recessed cutting tip or offset so that the sample is slightly smaller than the cylinder. And then this little section here is welded on with a little hole in it for a pin to connect the two sections. This shows it with the pieces. Here's the top part, little hole there. This is the bottom part, the pin goes through here. Then this cylinder was threaded, that part was welded there. Then it was threaded out so that we could screw in the tip. This is the rod used for pushing the sample out from the bottom onto the tray that's marked into increments. And this brush is used This brush is used for cleaning out the tip, and this brush is used for cleaning out the cylinder. And because the kind of things we were sampling, we could spray them with cooking spray to help the soil not to stick. Depending on what you're analyzing, that may or may not be good. I think this is not a total list, but I was looking for some of the type of things that were measured with this device. Soil bulk density, soil water content, organic carbon, plant residue, inert tracers like these spheres in, straws and whatever, plant pathogens, weed seed. I think I even heard someone, they say pH or something. So there's some other things that have been used with this that's been used for as well. I would like to describe one of Ray Almaris's study, which I found was very interesting. All of them were interesting, but this is just one of them. This was in 1996, okay. And basically the bulk of this study is he did this incremental sampling, and then they had these ceramic spheres that had been spray painted green so they could find them again. They put them on the soil surface, then they tilled, either moldboard, plow, or chisel. Then they sampled again. Then this time they put on some red ceramic spheres so they could tell the difference between what happened to from the moldboard tillage plow or the primary tillage, and what happened from the secondary tillage. And they did their secondary tillage, which was a cultivator and a harrow pulled behind it, and they sampled incrementally again. Now, I'm only going to present the first and last incremental sampling to simplify it, but they actually did 3. Okay, this is showing the bulk density with depth. The solid line is what the density was like before tillage, and then this dashed line with the triangles is after the secondary tillage, okay? So we can see that the soil was loosened up, but if you look at the moldboard, versus the chisel, there's a big difference. The moldboard, as we all know, inverts the soil. So we get this lot of loosening down at this depth, the 10 to 20 centimeter depth, and not as quite as much in the surface. The chisel plow loosens quite a bit at the surface, but it really doesn't loosen a whole lot at depth. It just barely stirs it. It's even more interesting when you look where these ceramic spheres ended up. The moldboard plow, after the primary tillage and after the secondary tillage, these spheres are down at 15 to 20 centimeters because it inverts the soil. After the secondary tillage, most of those red spheres are up in the top 7 centimeters. Now look at the chisel plow and what it does compared to the moldboard. Those green spheres are up at the 5 to 10 centimeter depth. They're not as deep. And people tell me, oh yeah, we chisel plowed to 25 centimeters deep. But did you really disturb the soil 25 centimeters deep? No. And then the secondary tillage was similar in the top 7 centimeters. Now this is of interest to me, both this and the previous. Recently I've been reading some papers on tillage erosion where they use cesium-137 and they try to look at how the tillage tool is throwing the soil. And so the first thing they do, and their assumption is, well, all tillage homogenizes the soil to 25 or 30 centimeters, and then we'll do our model from there. I'm thinking, what? This homogenizes the soil? Maybe the moldboard if you go back year after year, but not the chisel. And in terms of the soil material, it's not uniform. So I thought they must not have read Ray's papers. This is another little thing I'm throwing in here of how one of the things I've done with this tool. I've used this tool quite a bit, both incrementally. You can make the increments anything. You don't have to do 2 centimeters. We did somewhere we did 10 centimeters. And I had a whole bunch of data where I was actually looking at water content, but I got bulk density. Because with this tool, you can get bulk density and you can get the volumetric sample information. And so I said, well, I have this bulk density. I read this paper, Frazier, this was just this year, and they were looking at bulk density changes over time, and they were trying to relate it to changes in surface elevation. This doesn't even count things like erosion, deposition. Just as the soil is compressed, you know, if a tillage tool goes over it, then the elevation is lower. Okay, so the bulk density is higher, the elevation is lower. If you fluff up the soil, the elevation is higher as the bulk density is lower. That makes sense? Okay, this was followed over about 2.5 years. This 30 centimeter depth, that's just sort of the mean density. So we're taking that as the mean elevation because we sampled the 30 centimeters. And then this is just the variation in the bulk density over time. This was the mean of 15 samples to the 30 centimeter depth. And there was, you know, fluctuations over time. It's kind of interesting, this little big, you know, fluffing up at this time. They had chiseled in the fall after corn. There was some freeze-thaw, which did temporarily help fluff up the soil. However, as soon as they got their traffic in the spring, they lost the whole thing, which is pretty typical. Soybean, this was after the soybean year. They didn't till after soybean, but there still was some freeze-thaw, and it still got a little bit higher fluffing or less lower density, but again in the spring, as soon as they get in there with the traffic, they lost it all. Of greater interest here was the fall of 2009. They did corn and they chiseled in the fall. But then we had very heavy snow cover, and the snow cover started in middle of November and we had it till the middle of March. And we never did get a good solid soil freeze. There's just little pockets. So the overwinter plus the spring traffic, it was far worse. So if you think that tillage always helps your soil, not always. So this is just an idea of something that could be done. And this is you know, data I just had. I hadn't even published anything like this with the sampler. The most important things I learned from these incremental samplers are that different tillage tools disturb the soil to different depths. They do not leave the tillage zone anything close to uniform, and it varies by tool. The moldboard plow moves material deeper than other tillage tools. And Jane just finished a talk on on the application of all this residue and crop shoot work of Ray, and I think this even understanding where the residue is in the soil helps to contribute toward understanding residue burial, carbon sequestration. I mentioned the tillage erosion models and how the assumption of a homogeneous soil is really not very accurate. And I just thought we could even do things like elevation change over time. I think the only regret I have is that Ray Almaris never patented the device. As far as I know, I'm the only one who uses it because we had it, yeah. You were using it too? Great, glad to hear that. But anyway, because again, he was more into let's get the tool to get the job done, and he didn't want to make a name for himself. A little bit of time, I want to discuss another topic that Ray Almaris worked on, and this was the plant water uptake. And this, I know it's a lot of equations, but essentially what they had is they had neutron probe that measured soil water. They went out each week, and a tensiometer that measured soil water pressure head. And they had water retention curves that related the two. That was laboratory water retention curves. And then using some equations, they could come up with the hydraulic conductivity. The tensiometers gave this H gradient, which is the difference in the tensiometer head level at two positions. And from this, this DVZ was the flux of water. If right after a rain, the flux of water is down. However, as the roots take up water, you start getting the flux of water going more up to replace that water that's lost. And their deepest tensiometer was 137 centimeters deep. So they looked at the flux at that 137 centimeter depth. Okay, this was in the summer from July 15 to August 15. There was not a whole lot of rain during this month. This would be sort of like the month of maximum water uptake. So at the start of the study, there was perhaps even a little bit of drainage. It must have just rained. The brown line, this is their calculated upward flux based on their tensiometer pressure head difference and their laboratory measurements from which they get their hydraulic conductivity. And as you went longer and longer with very little rain during this time of maximum water uptake, the amount of water moving up into the root zone from below was up to 5 centimeters. In soybean, in corn, it was up to even 6 or 7 centimeters, millimeters a day. It's a lot of water. But when they look at the soil water depletion, or how much water was lost from the soil, at the same time, it was only about 3 millimeters a day. So a lot of the water that the plant is using that's available to the crop is not from the root zone. If it's wetter below the root zone, in these kinds of soils, it can move up from below. Well, I was really intrigued by this. So I did some further study on this, what I'm calling this net upward flux of water. But we have different tools now. At that time, all they could do was go out once a week and make their measurement. We can continuously monitor soil water now. And we had colleagues doing evapotranspiration with eddy covariance. We measured the change in soil water over time. And I'm showing that, although we measured it hourly, I'm showing the daily change. And our deepest depth was 1.1 meter, but this was in June and early July, and the water table was not much deeper than that. So we could calculate, so I used a time between rain so there was no precipitation, and we calculated this net upward flux as a difference. All right, here, this line shows the evapotranspiration from the eddy covariance measurement. It was ranging from 2 to 6 millimeters a day. This is the upward flux calculated from difference. Now, because it's calculated from difference, there's some things early on which probably really were not upward flux. The soil was wet. Above our most shallow sensor, you're going to get some soil evaporation, especially perhaps in June when maybe the canopy was still filling in. So this negative is implying that there's drainage. The positive implies there's upward flux. So I really think early on there's mainly drainage, and this is just sort of an artifact if we're getting some soil evaporation and perhaps even some evaporation from the canopy. However, after about 6 or 7 days, I think this really is an upward flux of water at the 1.1 meter depth or the depth of the water table. So that as the plant uses water, it moves up from below to replace that water because of the gradient created by the drying soil. So the conclusion is The upward flux between these two studies contributed 40 to 80% of evapotranspiration during dry times when we had this wet soil or relatively shallow water table. And it shows the extreme importance of the interaction between the water table and root zone. And of course, Ray Almaris was not the only one who addressed this, but he was one of the early ones. So the last part of my talk was be great through others. I think that Joe Benjamin mentioned it. Ray Almaris wanted to get the data out, wanted to get stuff out. He didn't care who got the credit. He was there to help others learn truth, help others learn what was going on. And he was a real leader because the leader works through others. And maybe we can follow his example in that respect. So I think I'm going to stop there if there's time for some questions. I do have to apologize, so I have to leave after my talk for a meeting, but I will come back.
Okay, if there's any questions, no questions, any comments? We have another break here before we need to start again, so any comments or... Yes, Ms. Piro.
Sorry, you mentioned the nuclear
Yeah.
Also,
we use
that sampler for silica.
Oh, for silica, too?
The silica measurement, pH.
Yeah. I was just trying to look through the papers, but I'm sure I missed a few and didn't.
Just
all right. Well, that's great to hear. Yeah. So we also use it for silica, soluble silica, pH, and some other things. Yeah.
One thing your talk reminded me of, and I haven't heard yet in this symposium, was you talked about how we used to have to use the neutron probe, we used to monitor soil water content maybe once a week. And then, of course, many of us know that Clark Kopp and others developed that TDR system that allowed non-destructive monitoring of water content. But Ray played a role in making that work in the field.
That's right.
Now, Maris had the critical paper on automating and multiplexing the TDR system.
Right, exactly.
Allowed us to do that in the field. And that's another huge contribution that Ray was involved with.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So, Sally, I remember in college I was taught that the roots go out and explore the soil for water.
Yeah, and they do that.
They do that too. I just wondered what's more important, exploitation or is it more diffusion of water?
Well, I think it's probably better to get the roots to the water, but to some extent, there still is this movement just from the gradient created as the water, as the roots take up water. There's that gradient that some of that water moves, that there you get that water going back to the roots as well. It depends on the kind of soil. These were soils with relatively shallow water tables and wet soil. If you go to some of the arid regions where the water table's 200 meters down, you're not going to have that.
So how... shallow a water table at 10 meters or at 15 meters or 2 meters?
I don't know. I mean, I've certainly seen with 2 meters it can contribute. Probably 10 is too much.
So you said it contributed 40%?
Yeah, 40, even sometimes even more.
That's a lot.
It is. It's a lot. When we think about available water, it's not only what's in that root zone, but if it's wet below the root zone, there can be a lot more available water.
Okay.